ça commence
aussi.
Ah,
c'est recording, is it?
Hello, everybody. As one of my panel have just said, when trying to explain what she was doing over here, she's talking about personal history with about 300 of you. And this is the way in which oral history is made. This is the second of these personal history sessions. And you've got to tell us if the sound doesn't work. Could you wave in the back row? Can you hear? Well, you're waving, so you must be able to. My name is Kate Pretty. I'm one of the university's five Pro Vice Chancellors, but I'm also the only archaeologist among those five. And this period that the panel is going to talk about is also my time as an archaeologist. However, I'll come back to that in a minute. We have some housekeeping. Everybody can see the way out. Nobody's to sit on the stairs. Are you all sitting comfortably? Now, before we start, we should greet, those of us from Cambridge should greet students and staff from the Universities of Manchester. I'm going to, as your university comes up, please wave and we can see whether it's true. Manchester. Liverpool. Thank you. Leicester. Southampton, Reading, Oxford, Central Lancashire, Fife, Kent, East Anglia, the Institute of Archaeology, and University College London, Goldsmiths, University of Cambridge. And have we got students from Hills Road Sixth Form College?
Students.
Yeah? Not students. Okay. Fellows of the Society of Antiquaries of London. Well done. And members and members of the Cambridge Antiquarian Society. Yep. Super. So as you see, you're drawn from all over. And when we get to question time, I'm going to ask you to say your name and where you're from. And because there are prizes for certain questions, what your status is. Oh, well, you're an undergraduate, a postgraduate, a postdoc. Please don't sit on the stairs. Can you come and sit? Otherwise, if there's a fire, you'll get trampled. Thank you very much. We should be thanking the funders, Thurston Shaw, the Scrabble Group, the Sorrento Hotel, the Quaker Meeting House, the Society of Antiquaries of London, the Cambridge Department of Archaeology, the MacDonald Institute of Archaeological Research, the Crowther Bennion Fund, the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, Anglia Ruskin University, and the Museum Tea Committee, who have just done their best for you. And I should add to that Pamela Jane Smith, to whom we're all very grateful indeed. Now, the running order is that the four panelists, if that's what you call them, will go in alphabetical order. That is, as it were, the way we decided it. So Meg Conkey will precede Henrietta Moore, who will be followed by Ruth Tringham, who will be followed by Alison Wiley, who is going to have the last word. And they're going to speak for about 10 to 15 minutes on the subject of the ways in which they, in their professional and personal lives, adapted to the 1970s and 1980s in terms of archaeological theory. At least that's, I think, the brief that they've been given. During that time, those of you who were born well after that period, I should remind you that we might start the whole period with 1968 with David Clark's Analytical Archaeology. In 1972, Lewis Binford published an archaeological perspective, which he gave a recension of in 1983 in Pursuit of the Past. But for those of you who, like me, are really culture historians, because I'm a Romanist and early medievalist. This was a period which we almost certainly will forget as we go on through the theoretical discussions, a period in which enormous numbers of things happened technically. Philip Barker published Techniques of Archaeological Excavation in 1977. We were discovering far more material. It was a period when we could start to understand what lay beneath the ground without excavation. We had huge amounts of data. Sieving had started on archaeological sites. There was a recovery of vast amounts more of material. And computerization started in order to allow us, not to allow us to handle this, but with an effect which allowed us to think that we could handle it. For those of you who remember that period, we were dealing in Wroxeter with a Commodore PET at about this period, an unknown phenomenon to most of you. Ed Harris published Principles of Stratigraphy in 1979 in an attempt to make things more objective. And at the same period, certainly in the UK, we started to take a greater interest in public archaeology. Rescue was founded in 1971 because of the destruction to the past which had come with the boom, post-war boom in digging and in the destruction of land through deep ploughing. It's also a period in which we find ourselves with, and others will speak of this, I'm absolutely sure, Meg, the growth of interest, at least among the profession, in what was happening to women. Barbara Williams published her Women in Archaeology in 1981. And it's a shock to me, and perhaps to you, that engendering archaeology didn't actually happen to come into print till 1991. And all the things which are such familiar territory to you, like who owns the past and the public policy of that, is actually relatively recent and belongs to the 90s and not to the period we're talking about now. But Henrietta and I will remember a stage where in this university we fought for the greater increase in the number of women in the university who would be able to make decisions. We belonged, she and I, to the Cambridge University Women's Action Group. And those of you who remember that stage will know that in a way what we were doing privately was beginning to invade the ideas that we had publicly. You're not here to listen to me. I am here to keep the discussion in order. So I'm going to start by asking Meg to start by telling us about herself. And the reason I'm not doing a potted bio is because your whole purpose is to listen to autobiography, not to biography. Thank you.
System from Kate. Can you all hear me? You're okay? Okay. Now, first of all, I do want to thank, of course, Pamela Smith for organizing us and getting us here, some of us from many thousands of miles away. And I want to thank Kate, who's going to keep everybody in order. I don't know if she can keep the four of us in order. We all have quite a history of being unruly together, so we're trying to give ourselves a day. My take on this today was that we should be talking a little bit about some of the strands of connections. I'm very interested, have always been interested in sort of social networks, both in the past and in the present, so that's really what I'm going to do is try and fill in some of the interstices of some of the kinds of things that went on. We see here the production of a number of books that we've all had some part in or something or other, but behind each and every one of them, as you all know, lie all sorts of relationships and incidences and kinds of things that happen either randomly or by chance or intentionally. I'm really concerned with the fact that the production of archaeological knowledge really is, of course, distributed knowledge, and we're all involved in the co-production of it. So from my personal history, I think it's important to point out that my beginnings in archaeology at the University of Chicago really are deeply rooted in what was then called the New Archaeology and later became called Perceptual Archaeology. At the University of Chicago, my supervisor there, Les Freeman, was part of the Binford's first generation of students, especially from the 1 year Binford taught at Chicago, and this includes people like Ken Flannery, Bob Whalen, Jim Hill, Bill Longacre, Stu Strever. And of course, prior to that was Patty Jo Watson, who was one of the few women archaeologists at Chicago, and I certainly felt the effects of being probably the fourth PhD in archaeology at Chicago at the time. Of course, at Chicago, it wasn't so much the faculty, but it was the students who actually carried the day. In fact, one year we had no archaeology faculty in residence, and so we convened our own seminars. And basically, this was Fred Clogg, John Fritz, who happened to have been my first cousin, Chuck Redman, and many other people. So you should know that there are these kinds of relations and connections. And many of them in this group, and especially, but not me, forming the core of at least the North American version of New Archaeology, actually were associated with a field school, a particular archaeological summer field school in Vernon, Arizona, that spawned Mike Schiffer, Ezra Zubra, Mark Leone, Tim Earle, and many of these other people. So that really came out from a grassroots, ground-up kind of situation. From the sphere of influence, what always influenced me or interested me was the whole idea of what we today, and even back then, were calling social geographies, and how, as Eden Binford talked about, the differential participation of people in the making of the styles and the material world that we dealt with as archaeologists. And so, to put it in sort of Binfordian jargon, which is actually what I came from, I was always interested in the social sources of variation in material culture. Or, as Lou used to say, things like the nature and the significance of sources of variation. My own PhD dissertation, which probably people don't know too much about, was on what we call design structure and social interaction. But unlike North Americanists, this was a the context of the Upper Paleolithic of Europe, and it was really inspired by two things. On the one hand, it was inspired by a paper written by Margaret Hardin, then Margaret Hardin Friedrich, in American Antiquity, published in 1972, on design structure and social interaction, where she dealt with pottery making among ethnographic or ethno-archaeological population of Tarascan potters. And it was also influenced as a Paleolithic archaeologist by, as I put him, the Paleolithic archaeologist that America should have hooked up with in its Paleolithic archaeology, but never did until maybe too late, and that's André Le Ragueron. And Le Ragueron, of course, we now know, was, of course, dependent upon and his work in a structuralist vein was very much influenced by the work of Annette Lamy-Imperaire, or the woman behind the throne, and also by the writings of the Marxist art historian Max Raphael. So there are these deep intellectual histories that inform everything that we do. So my concerns at the time were, what can variation in material culture provide to us as archaeologists to infer social relations? And in fact, what was intended to be the first chapter of my PhD dissertation, which sat on the shelf for some time, actually ended up in the 1978 version of Social Archaeology, edited by Chuck Redman and many others. Now, two things happened to me in the early 1970s that I can see where some of the kinds of trends have come from. This was in California. I participated in two completely separate discussion groups, both of which were quite formative. One was an archaeological discussion group mobilized by the late Lynn Isaac at Berkeley. And because of Lynn's work at looking at the development of symbolism and cultural behaviors and language and home bases in the middle and lower Paleolithic, he and I, with my working from the upper Paleolithic sort of found, had a lot to talk about. In fact, I would have to say that out of all of the mentors I ever had, I think Lynn was perhaps the most influential and the most encouraging mentor that I ever had. At this particular group that he organized in Berkeley, there were two people who were working on things that became part of what we think of as the 1980s, but are happening in the early 1970s. And one is a linguist, Mary LeCron Foster, a structural linguist, and the other is Jim Dietz, whose work is well known as an early a version of using, in this case, Henry Glass's structuralist approaches. And in 1977, I participated in a conference that Nikki Foster, the linguist, organized at the Berg-Wartenstein Castle of the Wendergren Foundation, and I wrote a paper there, which then somehow got loose. You know, papers you write, somebody picks it up and sends it to somebody, and they're sort of out there. And I think Ian Hodder had access to it probably through Linda Donnelly. And when Ian came to Binghamton, which is where I was on the faculty in the late 1970s, to a spatial analysis conference. He, at that point, told me he was thinking of organizing a conference on symbolic and structural archaeology, and which I did attend. And many other people attended that who had been doing some work in these lines, like Mark Leone and others, many of whose papers actually did not appear in the final edited volume. The other group that I was influenced by was meeting in the early 1970s, and this was a group of feminists and social and cultural anthropologists and some biological ones as well in the San Francisco Bay Area, much of which became the now classic 1974 volume edited by Michelle Rosaldo and Louise Lanthier called Women, Culture, and Society, 1974. And the reason that I mentioned this is because, as Kate has just indicated, she was shocked that 1991 was when Engendering, or as my French colleagues call it, Endangering Archaeology, was published. Is that many of us brought to all of the events that led to that actually quite a long history of engagement with some of the issues, both personally as well as professionally. I come from a long line of educated women. My great-great-grandmother got a BA from Mount Holyoke College, which I also attended. I'm the eldest of five daughters, and I was involved in undergraduate activism around women's issues in the 1960s. In 1972, I taught a course on women in evolutionary perspective, and also I chaired in 1975 the American Anthropological Association Committee on the Status of Women in Anthropology. And it was part of that early 1970s experience that I suggested to Mike Schiffer, then editor of Advances in Archaeological Method and Theory, that he should get somebody to do something on gender and feminism in archaeology. And as a good editor, he said, great, you're on. And he also mentioned that somebody else had approached him about this, Janet Spector. And she and I then began writing what was the 1984 publication on gender in archaeology. And it's also of note that Janet and I did all of that without ever having met each other. And this is in the days of typewriters, carbon paper, no money for long-distance phone calls, no internet, no email. And that took quite some time because we had a lot of other obligations. I was a junior faculty member, as was she. And so between 1978, when we started on it, and 1984, when it was finally published, it took some time. So in a way, many of the kinds of building blocks to what we see today, some even decades later, actually are in place, and people are engaged in these kinds of ideas. And in fact, I'd just like to make one interesting point about, interesting to me anyway, about a comparison between the so-called sort of formative conference on symbolic and structural archaeology held here in 1980 and here in Cambridge, and then the conference that led to Engendering Archaeology held in 1988. Most of the work that I think Ian drew on to put together the Symbolic and Structural Conference was based on things that were out there, as well as the work of his own students. But when Joan Jarrow and I organized the conference that became Engendering Archaeology, we did not have people who were already working on a subject. We took people like Ruth, and she's well known for her response to this, and said, you really know your subject matter, your architecture, your ceramics, your archaeobotanical work. Now think it through again from the perspective of gender or feminism. We had a conference, Henrietta was a discussant, Allison was also there, and where people were asked and responded to think their materials through from a completely different perspective, and I think that that was really one of the incredible strengths of the conference, the contrast between the papers that people wrote and the papers that they submitted to the volume are very, very different. There's much more that could be said about the subsequent paths of a social archaeology, about inquiries into the meaningfulness of material culture, and especially about gender and feminist archaeologies, what today many of us refer to rather as doing archaeology as a feminist. But instead of a top-down sort of categorical approach to archaeological schools, paradigms, or whatever you might want to call it, a theoretical label, I just wanted to conclude with reminding us that it's important to remember and see how a field, a discipline, or a practice is enacted by individuals in situated practices, in varying and bottoms-up kinds of trajectories that are historically contingent and not masterminded, and like all theories, have effects. That I'd like to think that when we talk about what we do as theorists in archaeology is that these are approaches that may and hopefully do change people and change the way in which people perceive the world, and that this will be different for different people situated in different places. So that's just sort of where I come from and some little tidbits. Let's turn it over to Henriette.
Thank you.
The interpretation or possible interpretations of meanings and the way in which they might vary. So you might be interested to know that rather than going in alphabetical order, we could also, for those of you who are interested in anthropological classification, be going in order of height. It'll be very important as time goes on. So now, please don't ask me about this, of course. When I was asked about what I can remember about 1979, I had total amnesia. Oh my goodness, 1979. And then I remembered, of course, that it was the year of the general election. And that meant, of course, that it was also rather a good year, not because Mrs. Thatcher was elected, but because at that time we had no idea how bad it was going to get. Now, when I went on to think about what had happened as a result of the things that we all did in 1979, I went looking, rather as people have done here, for various books on the bookshelf, and I discovered one called Archaeology as Long-Term History, which I contributed an article to, and that made me very nervous, because I realised that today we would have to be doing something about the genealogy of archaeology itself, a kind of archaeology of archaeology. And I also realised, of course, that for many people in this room, I would already be history. So it was a tough one. I'm not quite sure what sort of way to talk to you about these things. Now, there are many people in this room that I was a student with. There are many people in this room who taught me, and there are many people who've been my colleagues over the years. And so I don't want to be invidious in my recollection by not mentioning people's names. But for some of you, you might like to know that I was a student with, amongst others, Danny Miller and Christopher Tilley. And what we used to do is that we used to meet pretty much every day in the coffee room of the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, where we used to eat Cornish pasties from Fitz Billy's. Now, this was an enormously important activity, because when I went into the field a little while later in northern Kenya, and there was a cholera epidemic and indeed a famine, I spent much of my time dreaming about Fitzwilliam's which I remember vividly, and with an interesting sort of sensate embodied experience, which rather changed my own theoretical perspective on the value of phenomenology interpretation of what turned out to be my first book, Space, Text, and Gender. Now, at that time, you have to remember that when I attended the Friday afternoon seminars in the anthropology department, that Audrey Richards was still alive. I did not know then that I would, with Megan Bourne, do a major study of her first, well, actually her second, her PhD was on food, but her second book on the Bemba. Maya Fortis was still alive and regularly attended those seminars, as was Edmund Leach. Edmund Leach and I had a number of run-ins whilst I was a student, because one of the things about being a PhD student, and this may not apply to those of you who are PhD students at the moment, but it certainly applied to me, is that you're too young and stupid to know that you ought to be politer than you are. I was forever putting my foot in it in a variety of ways. And Edwin and I had a famous run-in over the question, of course, of whether feminism was simply a kind of ideology or not. And he said to me, the trouble with you is that you don't know that you are an ideologue, right? And I said, the trouble with you is that you won't say that you are one. So something he subsequently repeated in print, I got delighted and didn't. Now, actually, the 1970s were a time of immense intellectual optimism in Cambridge. Immense intellectual optimism. I mean, we really thought we were changing something. I have to say that from time to time, we were a little bit unclear about exactly what it was we were saying, but we did think that we were moving things forward. And I think that one of the reasons why we thought that was that there was a kind of confluence between the passion we felt for the work that we were doing and the kinds of theoretical frameworks that we were trying to develop within that work. That is that we were interested in a kind of social theory that created space for human agency, for interpretation, for a kind of creative practice. And that informed not only what we were doing in our work, but as Kate has mentioned, for some of us, in our political work as well. And I was not only a member, of which I'm enormously proud to have been a member of the Cambridge University Women's Action Group, but I was also a member of something called the Cambridge Women's Resource Centre, which was something which tried to get town women from the town and women from the university, or from gown and town, as it was then known, together to do something about women's employment and women's training in the city of Cambridge. And we were largely successful because we had backing from the university, in fact, from Jesus College substantially in the first instance. And that kind of feminist activism that we were involved in was an enormously important part of the way in which I approached my work. It was an enormously important part because I was interested in the question of political economy. I was interested in the question of what difference do systems of production and reproduction make to the way that people are able to live their lives and how men and women are differentially placed within those systems. And this was something that formed the basis, really, of my first PhD work in Kenya. Now, I think that Danny Miller and Chris Tilley and I and a number of other people, we used to meet regularly as a group to discuss various kinds of theoretical texts. The chief problem with these discussions was that Danny Miller and Chris Tilley always wanted to discuss Hegel, and nobody else did. Now, I, as a result, can't remember too much about Hegel, because this is a sort of form of amnesiac resistance which the rest of us were practicing at the time. But out of those discussions did come a very sustained critique of a number of different kinds of thinkers. Of course, first of all, we had Tony Giddens on our doorstep, and we talked much about human intention and motivation, much about the problem of what is, as he had said, the great problem of social theory, which is the relationship between structure and agency. And out of that, I, in my own work, developed an interest in the writings both of Pierre Bourdieu and his writing on habitus, and of the work of Paul Ricoeur. And I think that's an important development for me, because at the time, post-processional archaeology was gaining a great deal, not only from sort of the ideas of interpretation, but from structuralism itself. And you must remember that the great texts of structuralism which were underpinning post-processional archaeology in the early 1980s were actually most of them published in French in France in the 1950s. And these ideas have been around for quite some time. Whereas both Bourdieu and Ricoeur were moving in slightly different directions. Bourdieu, of course, much more towards the embodied nature of structuring structures, and Ricoeur much more against or away from simple ideas of alternation, transposition, the basic structural principles of language, towards an idea of what did it mean for people to actually speak in sentences competently. So he wasn't a Chomskyan, but he had an idea of how you would approach the interpretation of a text at large, and that's the idea that I took forward in space text and gender. And from there, everything really began. Now, Kate, how many more time?
5 more minutes.
Oh, okay. Right.
You don't have to.
Well, maybe just a couple more things. So I benefited enormously from the fact that I met Meg Conkey in 1980 when I was a graduate student. I think that's probably one of the most marvellous things that ever happened to me, and one of the most satisfying intellectual relationships. And that spun off into one with Ruth and one with Alison. As Meg said earlier, we've been renowned for many years now for causing quite a lot of trouble together. And what satisfaction it has given us. That's a pleasure to work with three really great minds on all kinds of issues. And I have truly, really enjoyed being, as I now am thought of, as the anthropologist who hangs out with archaeologists. It's been a huge treat, and I'm going to stop there.
Thank you. Are you really the next in line?
I'm the next in line. I am the second tallest. I'm going to actually stay here because I can. You all see me and you can all hear me. Okay. Can you?
Can I hear you?
Good. I'm going to sit here because I have my little friend here, and I want to thank Pamela. Thank you, Pamela, for making an excuse for the four of us, good and wonderful friends, to get together. And also for making us think in a self-conscious way about our intellectual biographies. I think what doing something like this does is increase our awareness of how our ideas are part of accumulation of ideas and knowledge. It makes you realize that the books you come across, perhaps sometimes quite randomly, and the friends you meet and hear and talk to, the discussions that you may become part of, are sometimes, some of these are quite by chance, but they inspire and stimulate you to build on them your own response. And when you're living this, it's sometimes hard to be aware of it, although you should be, because it might help you not make mistakes. But still, it's very important, I think, to, it really helps to be made aware of it in hindsight. So far from being a story about the beginning of post-processual archaeology, actually my story picks up from where the boys last year left off, especially Mike Schiffer. In 1975, Mike Schiffer and I were both at a small conference organized by Richard Gould called Explorations in Ethnoarchaeology. Mike was using modern material culture to define some principles of the formation of archaeological deposits that you will have heard about last year. My task was to show the connections. At least that's how I interpreted my task, since I had not ever done any ethnoarchaeology, that I was to make the connections between experimentation and ethnoarchaeological observations. And I did this with a very elaborate diagram about, I called it leapfrogging, and along the way actually made some big leaps in my own thinking about middle-range research, or middle-range theory, as some of you like to call it, and the nature of knowledge construction in archaeology. Lewis Binford, who was not invited to participate in that party, was also writing about middle-range research at this time. It's interesting that we both came at it at the same time in quite separate ways. He, on the other hand, however, thought that he invented it, and actually none of us invented it. It was invented way, way before him by some sociologists. But the idea of creating empirical hypotheses or bridging arguments between empirical data collection and more general arguments on an evolutionary scale or prehistory writ large, which was so popular with processual archaeologists, became a means to making the new archaeology workable, or that's how we saw it. So I was right in the middle there of making the new archaeology workable. There were two big strands that twined together in my archaeological career in the late 1970s and 80s, and middle-range research was one of them. The other was the Neolithic of Southeast Europe. And as with any twining rope, developments in one strand triggered a response in the other strand, and so on, so that it's very difficult to work out the exact sequence of events, but I'll try and do a little of that now. I'd been working for many years, or several years at that time, by the late 1970s, experimenting to replicate the microware or contact traces on flake stone tools. I'd been hired by Harvard University 1972 not to do anything with microware or stone tools or be a lithic cowgirl, as I was, but to do sort of straight European prehistory. So immediately I got to Harvard, I abandoned that idea. It's very funny. History repeated itself, I think, when I went to Berkeley 7 years later. I was hired to do stone tools and be a lithic cowgirl, but then I abandoned that and became a Marxist. But anyway, so that's just jumping ahead a little. So the application of this microware knowledge or contact trace knowledge and middle-range research was aimed towards an understanding of, at that time, of activities and resource use. The relationships of humans to the material world is what Richard Gould summed up our ethnoarchaeology conference with. But as I wrote up the 1975 paper, this application became focused on understanding the use life of the artifact. So what had happened in between this time was that I had been working in Southeast Europe at Celovac from 1975, between 1975 and 1997. And here I was working with people who had already been part of Schiffer's use life concept, who had been helping him develop that. People like Cheryl Klassen, who was participating in my Celovac project as a graduate student in Harvard. So I'd been working on Southeast European prehistory since the 1960s, but the explorations of ethnoarchaeology conference coincided with the planning and directing of my first field project at Celovac. Before this, I had never directed any field project at Celovac. I'd been a lithic cowgirl, as I keep repeating, and that meant that I'd been analysing other people's stone tools, including Colin Renfrew's at Sitagree. But Harvard wanted me to have my own project. This was political, but anyway. So I had to create my own project, and I chose Yugoslavia because I was interested in Eastern Europe, and Yugoslavia was the most accessible to take a team of people rather than just be there as an individual. So I had wanted to work on the Mesolithic-Neolithic transition. That was my big history project. But that didn't actually happen for various reasons. It's a long story, and I don't have time to tell many stories. But anyway, the site I was assigned was a late Neolithic one, very different program, very different project. But my role in this project became making sure that the use life of lithics and all the other materials except for architecture that were excavated, were recorded with a very complicated computerized attribute system, all stages of their use lives. So this was quite an innovative way of recording your materials rather than focusing on their style or their actual form. We were actually interested in what their history was. So at first, the excavated context was delegated to people who knew more about that, meaning my Yugoslav colleagues or other colleagues from America who knew more than I did about excavating. And at first, the excavated context... So at first, my project at Celovac then was focused on the analysis of the excavated materials. That's what I was in charge of. And I was very interested in very mundane things. Now I think of it as mundane, such as resource utilization and so on. But I was definitely in need of better models for the context of the utilization of materials, better than, for example, the establishment of the Neolithic and its inevitable developing or evolving complexity, as was the usual culture history model that I was working with at that time. I needed more than just the explanation of the process of the intensification of production, which was a kind of new archaeology model that I was working with. I was just not very satisfied, and I felt that there was a real need. Here I was really working with developing methods to bring out the most from an excavated materials, but I didn't really know, I didn't really have any rich model with which to, which would be satisfying for me, to use this information. So I was not the only one working with this conundrum. It was actually rather a something that really happened with the new archaeology at that time in the late 1970s. They were coming up with these really highly developed middle-range research projects, but not knowing where to take them. So they became an end in themselves. So that much of the new archaeology at that time had nowhere to go. And fortunately, I had a boost at that time from a number of directions, mostly offshoots of Marxism and historical materialism. Some of it was from some graduate students who had been taking Stanley Tambaya's course in Marxist economic, or really a deconstruction of Marxism in anthropology, but they brought that those ideas about the social implications of sedentism and intensification of production to my attention. And I started reading on that. Another very important book for me that came out round about this time was Friedman and Rowland's The Evolution of Social Systems, that had articles by a number of people, including David Harris, on the social implications of sedentism, and by Friedman and Rowland's themselves on the epigenetic model for, well, it was really talking about the importance of looking at the social relations of production beyond just the means of production, which I was looking at. There were a number of other articles, really very interesting articles, by, for instance, Maurice Godelier in the same book. And it became clear that there was an obvious need in what I was doing to bring in some kind of a social context. I can't believe, in hindsight, that I wasn't doing that before. But previously, it had been quite mechanical. So what I did then was to really develop in order to develop the social context of the use life of the artifacts, I realized that I had to have something about the social and spatial context, more about that in my archaeology, and I sort of began to focus on architecture at that time. And these became the last days of my lithic cowbell days. So any of you who still think I'm doing the microware of lithics, please forget that. It's not happening anymore. My next excavation project in the 1980s at Opovo really focused on this, the use lives of houses in and through the study of the architectural materials, through this middle-range research into the architectural materials themselves, looking at the destruction of houses as much as their construction. And one of the things that happened in the early 1980s, which was very important for me, a couple of things happened. I went to Paris to teach for a semester there, and actually met Godelier. He was called Momo at that time. He was a terrifying character, and quite as frightening as Henrietta, but even more so because I had to speak French to him, and that was very difficult. But I also met Claude Meyassou, who was working in a little more, he was a little easier for me to get a understand. And I was teaching a course on economic archaeology at that time, and really started then to do a lot of heavy reading in Marxist models of historical materialism, social relations of production. At the same time, another book came out, and quite by chance I found it while I was in Paris, and this was a special volume put out by Wilken and Rathje called Household Archaeology. And when I saw this, I realized, this was the key to various parts of my intellectual development. It provided me with a very interesting model, a series of models for the archaeology, for a way to deal with the social relations of production. If you're thinking then of the household as the smallest unit of social reproduction, this was a way that I thought I could actually demonstrate social transformation with archaeological data, and that was my main That was my main thing, was to try to get empirical data to talk about these very big scale projects. So it was this, the household archaeology was something I really developed during the Opovo project, and that's going all the way through the 80s. And other people had picked up on household archaeology in slightly different ways, or in some of them slightly similar ways to what I was doing. And one of the ways that they were doing was to treat the household, this, you know, was a new thing, the household, let's find the household. So the household became the small unit of analysis. It was a way to understand settlement archaeology, to really get a handle on what was happening in a settlement, to be able to look at intra-site settlement analysis, to be able to extrapolate from one excavated house to the whole settlement and look at things like social inequality. That was one of the things that I was doing. So you had on the one hand the analysis of households, and on the scale, the micro-scale analysis of households. On the other hand, you also had the interpretation of households. So this was, many people were not doing that. Many people were just treating it as something that was, oh, it was just a small unit of excavation or a small unit of analysis. But you could take it much further, thinking of it as a small unit of interpretation. In this case, you're looking at changes in one house versus another house. You're really trying to understand a settlement through the social inequality between households. What I was missing here was to understand, and this is where the whole households with faces stuff comes in, what I was missing was that however detailed I got, I never got within the household, nor did anybody else. And that's that. I took this most brilliant paper, I thought it was a brilliant paper, to this conference that Alison and Henrietta and Meg were at, the one in 1988, and talking about households as the way in which you could put women in households. Well, of course women are in households. Yes, women were in households. How could they not be, and so on. But it was actually really hard. I didn't know quite how to go about it. And that's where this whole aha thing came, when Henrietta said, can you describe the households? So far I've just been thinking of them, one household versus another household. One household having its in the middle of its cycle while another is dying. Let's try and identify that in a settlement. She said, well, what do they look like? So I said, what do you mean, what do they look like? Well, what do you see when you see a household? And the first thing I could see was, well, I can see cows. So then she says, well, what do they look like? And that's, I don't know if anybody knows this story, but anyway, it was a real epiphany for me in a way, being told, tell me what they look like, describe the faces, describe the people. And so for the first time, I was able actually to think of people, individuals, within households, which of course then brought me very much in line with the whole post-processual emphasis on individual social practice, individual social action, and the understanding of individual social agency. But I hadn't thought of it in that way. I was thinking of it more in terms of a release as well. In this 1988 conference was terribly important for me in terms of not having to demonstrate something, demonstrate a fact, a proven fact, through middle range research with the archaeological data. I could now use middle range research for a much richer interpretation to take advantage of the problematization of ambiguity, for example. Instead of trying to deny ambiguity, you would then say, yeah, it's really good. That's what it's all about. So then we would have the idea of multiple voices, multiple plausible interpretations, multiple scales of analysis, micro-scale fall up to the big picture that all have to be studied. So the next problem was then, how would you ever write about this? these multiples, this network, this web of multiplicities. So that's one, I think that for me became the next challenge of how to do that. And the computerization, which had been going on all along through the 80s, was terribly important, but only really became the great significance for me in the 1990s, but that's another story.
We tall girls stay seated. I kind of focused on the brief to think about what it was like to be training as an undergraduate and graduate student in the 70s and early 80s at a point when post-processualism was forming. And the first thing, as I was thinking about that, so I have a really complicated relationship to post-processualism, and I'm glad to hear that it's pretty much similar. I mean, all... Yeah, I now don't feel like it. Maybe it's not so complicated. It's actually kind of similar to everybody else's, because in many ways I was interested in, as Ruth put it, trying to make new archaeology work. I mean, my induction into archaeology and my interest in philosophical issues in archaeology, the point at which my archaeological field experience and practice came into really active engagement with my philosophical training was through the New Archaeology. I was drawn into New Archaeology in the archaeological field, working as a field assistant for Parks Canada's site in southwest Saskatchewan, where there are real cowboys and lots of lithics. I had the director of that project at Fort Walsh was a dyed-in-the-wool new archaeologist who had been trained at the University of Arizona, exactly in the cohort that Meg was describing. And he was very insistent that any work we did in the field had to be problem-oriented, even though Parks Canada just wanted us to generate data to put in, you know, sort of a museum-type setting and document the details of what the Northwest Mounted Police, the glorious Northwest Mounted Police, were doing in the Canadian, on the Canadian frontier in the 1860s. He had a much more ambitious agenda, and he really enforced or forced on us or pushed us to try to bring those ambitions into practice, to try to make what was otherwise a kind of salvage operation a much more interesting, problem-oriented operation. And in fact, the social lives, the complexities of the social lives of people who aggregated in these 2,000 person, very culturally and otherwise heterogeneous community for just this fluorescence of about 6 years in a part of the Canadian prairie where, you know, once the railway went through 30 miles north, just dissipated into ranches that are an average of 23 sections, that is square miles in size. I mean, the density in the 1860s was many thousand times population-wise what it is now. Our focus there was really on the social, the problems we were addressing had to do with the social dynamics of a contact zone, of a rapidly moving frontier, political economic agendas of forming, in the case of Canada, nation states. So this was all framed as part of the agenda of the new archaeology, right? This interplay of agency and large scale political structure. That was a set of new archaeology problems that we were urged to try to address in archaeological terms in the field. So that's how I was drawn into the new archaeology. It was in the context of field practice. As an undergraduate, I was an undergraduate between 72 and 76 at a small college in New Brunswick. There wasn't any archaeology being taught in that college, so I was drawn to philosophy and very quickly found myself in philosophy of science classes. And what was striking there is that this tyrannical director who made us commit new archaeology had us read a whole lot of philosophy. Hempel, Kuhn, a whole lot of philosophy of science. And I then found myself studying it more systematically as an undergraduate. And I very quickly came to the view that I didn't quite understand why the new archaeologists were so enamored of hypothetical-deductive this and, you know, deductive nomological models of X. I mean, it was, you know, as a second-year undergraduate, it was pretty clear to me that this was a category mistake. The new archaeology was ill-served by its positivist rhetoric. Its ambitions were vastly outstripped the models of scientific practice that the new archaeologists were appropriating from logical positivism. I had the good fortune of to be able to bring my archaeological field interests together with these growing philosophical interests in the context of a short-lived graduate program at SUNY at Binghamton. It was called a program in History and Philosophy of the Social Behavioral Sciences. It existed for about 3 years. Its director died tragically in the second year of the program. Resources for it dissipated. But I was able to, my thesis supervisor is actually at Oxford, Ram Hare. He visited every fall. He was a powerful influence as a philosopher of social science. And then there was the whole slate of archaeologists. The year that I started graduate work in 1976, Meg Conkey and John Pritz arrived. I had classes with you. And Chuck Redman, I think, had come the year before. Fred Plogg had been there and left, but there was a sort of enduring legacy. There was a hotbed of new archaeology. It was very interesting to be doing that slate of coursework. It was required for this history, philosophy of the behavioral and social sciences to come in with or get at least a master's level training in archaeology or in the social science you were studying. So I ended up doing most of the slate, a full slate of graduate coursework in archaeology alongside philosophy of science. But I was intrigued by the parallels between what was what I saw happening in archaeology, the ambitions of the new archaeology and a critique of traditional practice, and a development that was taking shape in social psychology that Ram Hare was at the time writing about. It's a complicated set of parallels here. Ram Hare had a realist critique of the positivism that he argued underpinned and reinforced a narrow behaviorist focus in social psychology. The positivist commitment to be an upstanding person of science. In the positivist sense, you must not be speculating about unobservables, and that meant especially the contents of mind. I mean, what could be more ephemeral? So he understood that the behaviorist commitment to focus on stimulus response correlation. I mean, that was legitimated, that was warranted, that was mandated by positivist conceptions of what it was to do properly scientific inquiry. Hare's arguments and those of others within social psychology at the time, this is in the 70s, was that this was just the sense that you had to set psychology, social psychology, in this narrow frame was complete, because of what science required, was completely misguided. If you take seriously what physicists are doing, they're constantly so-called speculating about unobservables, or what Hempel described as taking detours through the realm of unobservables. As a realist, Ram Hare argued, and other realists, scientific realists argued, the goal of science is not to save the phenomena, a phrase from Duhem, but to use observations and phenomena as a basis for building and testing models of unobservables. The ambition is precisely to extend beyond unobservables. And so why, he said, should social psychology feel that they can't talk about cognitive maps, mental states, passions, intentions, beliefs, right? Because they're unobservable. I mean, physicists don't respect any such constraint on what they can talk about. Why should social psychologists? I found that very compelling. And the way it played out was this. It seemed to me that the new archaeologists were pushing a very similar ambition to what the social psychologists Hare was describing were pushing. They wanted to understand what lies behind and what produced, underlying or in the background, in the past, mechanisms and processes that were responsible for producing the archaeological record. They wanted to use archaeological material as a medium for getting at precisely what is not observable. And yet, ironically, they're going to have a Kuhnian revolution to do these grand, new, exciting things. And the revolution, on their account, required them to embrace positivism, right? I mean, as an undergraduate, since I was wrote a paper in my second year as an undergraduate about why this was just fundamentally at odds. There was a fundamental contradiction at the core of the new archaeology, right? Maybe not a contradiction if you think that positivism served just as a kind of warranting rhetoric. We're scientists, right? But fundamentally a contradiction if you take seriously the content of a logical positivist model of science. So I set about, as a grad student between 76 and 81, writing a dissertation on positivism and the new archaeology, which was meant to sort of do some conceptual ground clearing and help make the new archaeology a more coherent, you know, make it possible to realize these ambitions by framing a more consistent, more a conceptual framework in philosophical terms that would better support give a model of scientific practice that would better support the ambitions of the new archaeology. 1978, October 78, I believe it was, the conference on spatial analysis at Binghamton. Ian Hodder came, you mentioned. As a grad student, I went along to this and listened to Professor Hodder. It started off with an account of the kind of quantitative analysis he had been doing, inspired by quantitative geography. And then sort of abruptly, early in that lecture, said, but I think this is all, you know, you probably came here to, you know, hear me talk about packing models and, you know, regional centers and things. I now think that's completely misguided, and then did what Meg refers to as the blackboard, you know, flip this rolling blackboard up, and underneath was all this stuff about symbolism and structuralism and getting at underlying meanings. It was like, you could have heard a pin drop in that auditorium. It was quite dramatic. I actually took, and I found that quite compelling. This was the argument he was making at that time. I actually found a set of lecture notes that I'd taken. Am I allowed to use archive myself for oral history? it was quite intriguing to read these lecture notes. Hodder's focus was on critiquing what he referred to as functionalist adaptationist conceptions of material culture, right? So he was arguing at that time for expanding the conception, for conceptualizing cultural process in broader, richer terms. He was quite explicit, if my lecture notes are to be trusted. My notes on this point were, Hodder maintains the positivist scientific orientation of the new archaeology. I'm quoting myself, which I think, you know. Hodder is maintaining this commitment to a scientific orientation, but he's insisting on a more expansive, ethnographically richer conception of material culture. He said, material culture can't be understood only in terms of functions and behaviors, manifest behaviors and technical functions of material artifacts. It's necessary to understand cultural process. I mean, in order to understand cultural process, it's necessary to attend to the symbolic structures on several levels. He identified three levels in that lecture. I could only make sense of two in my notes. One was self-expression of identity. And the other was mind models or cognized worlds, right? So he's saying, if you're going to make sense of cultural process, you need to have this content. It sounded exactly like Ram Hurray and the social psychologists who were moving beyond behaviorism, right? You need to understand the insides of actions, to use Collingwood language. You need to understand the cognized worlds, the motivations, the symbolically rendered environments in which people move. But at that time, Hodder seemed to be pushing the possibility of setting this in a scientific, even positivist framework. It wasn't presented as a repudiation of the new archaeology as a whole, but as a way of actually doing what the new archaeology had hoped to do, get at cultural process. So I was going to be spending, this was October of 78, I was going to be spending the two terms, the following 79, January through June, at Oxford, finishing up exams, studying with Ram Hurray, getting my thesis underway. I wrote to Professor Hodder, and I actually just found a photocopy of that letter, which was fascinating reading, and said that I would be in the UK, and I'd like to come across and, you know, if I could visit the archaeology group that was meeting, that Henrietta was a part of, a graduate student group. And I laid out an argument in that letter, which dates to November 79, for reconsidering his scientism, reconsidering the positivism. I made an argument that, you know, right out of Hooray, and I was citing Hooray on this, and the parallel with social psychology, the positivism enforces a narrow focus on adaptationism, on behavior, on function in a narrow sense. And I argued by parallel with social psychology, his broadening of what cultural process could and should mean, his attention to the symbolic dimension of cultural action in the past, would require a fundamentally different epistemology, philosophy of science. I thought a realist philosophy of science. So I got to Oxford a couple months later, visited the Cambridge Archaeological Seminar, I think twice. Once I gave a paper, and the other I think I just came and hung out. It was an extraordinary group, just an extraordinary group of graduate students, which Henriette has described. There was, in addition to you and Tilly, Mike Parker Pearson, just a pantheon of people who have since become really key players in archaeology. And I learned by the time I got there, that several of the graduate students working with Ian were already developing, working on the same epistemic issues that I was working on, only they were drawing on the resources of post-structuralism, post-modern theorizing, French philosophical initiatives. I, being a pointy-headed analytic philosopher, was drawing on the resources of scientific realism. So, anyway, I thought I could explore alternatives within analytic philosophy of science that would create space for sustaining archaeological practice in this expanded frame. Am I at the end of my minutes?
Two.
Okay, 2 minutes. I guess I have about 2 minutes worth of the rest of my life, right? So, I found myself at once a critic of the new archaeology, of the programmatic positivism of the new archaeology, and a critic of the narrow, I didn't do a lot of work on this, but I didn't find compelling at all the reductive ecosystem model of culture, but an advocate for an epistemic position that was comparatively, that is compared to Tilly, for example, and Ian in some of his moods, comparatively conservative, a kind of scientific realism, an anti-foundationalism, as it were, constructivist about evidence, but the kind of constructivism about evidence that does not entail any form of meltdown relativism or wholesale skepticism. That was a pro-science reframing of the ideals of objectivity. At least as I understood it. And it was consistent. What I was doing with respect to archaeology was exactly consistent with what colleagues of mine were doing in philosophy of biology and the life sciences, and some philosophers of physics. There was a substantial reorientation within philosophy of science at that time, which supported exactly these moves. So, for some, the position I've taken has been just frankly illegible, just can't be construed, inscrutable. That particularly was brought home to me when I was at the Symbolism and Structuralism Conference in 1980. That was a wonderful conference. The lines had not been drawn as sharply then as they later were. I didn't feel, in working on symbolism and structuralism, that it was sort of a wrong number to announce the fact that I'm still an analytic philosopher of science and interested in scientific realism, right? When I came back to the Durham tag, which would be in the late 80s, I think it was Durham, this is the Cher Nyafi, am I remembering this right, session, who owns archaeology. It was, whenever I would walk into a room and there would be like silence. It was like the Antichrist. It was like, some force of evil was appearing, We were all being discussed as the reactionary, whatever. And it was this extraordinarily strained and awkward atmosphere in which I found myself cast in the role of a critic of post-processualism, or as having abandoned or turned or something. So I wanted to just draw attention to the fact that the lines were not nearly so sharply drawn at the time when these later defined positions were taking shape. Just one remark in addition to that, a number of you have talked about, Meg and Henrietta, about your grounding in feminist work. My feminist interests arise primarily, originally, out of feminist activist involvement, and not sometimes in the academy in the form of work on chilly climate, workplace environment issues, sometimes on domestic violence and workplace violence, women in poverty, race issues race and gender kinds of issues in practical contexts. It wasn't until I got drawn into teaching feminist philosophy in the early 80s, being a girl, it was assumed I could do that, right? And discovered a wonderful feminist philosophy of science literature that I've since been working in. But it wasn't until the Engendering Conference in 88 that it became possible for me to see how to bring those quite independent components of my interest together. And so it wasn't post-processualism at all that made that possible. The roots were quite different intellectually and politically for me, not rooted in post-processualism. And the work I'm now doing on feminist standpoint theory, all those pieces come together as components of an account of how it is that situated knowledge, values, interests, political commitments can enrich inquiry rather than figure as a contaminant of it. Okay? Thank you.
Right. We've heard four very different accounts, although they apparently intersect. It's interesting the ways in which they then spread out. We're now inviting you to ask questions. There are some rules of engagement. One of them is that you must say who you are, where you're from, and whether you're an undergraduate, postgraduate, postdoc, or older, because only some of you get prizes. Secondly, after what happened last year, I understand, I'm going to tell you that this chair will not allow you to ask your question in longer than 3 minutes. Thirdly, you might be allowed a follow-up, depending on how many other people want to speak, but if this starts to become too much of an interactive dialogue between one or other of you and the panel, I shall feel emboldened to interrupt. Is that all right?
Yes.
Great. And I think probably the best way forward is for you to be clear who you're addressing your comment to, unless it is that you want to elicit an answer from all four. Could you be... It's difficult for me to know quite where to deal the cows, the flints, the French practitioner, whatever. It will help me very much if you will say how you want to start. And I've been encouraged to say that if any undergraduate wants to start off, we'll go for beauty before age. The floor is yours.
You mean age before beauty?
Yes, I'm an undergraduate.
You're an undergraduate, well then. From?
From Cambridge, Richard Halliday.
Thank you.
It seems to me that Chomsky's accounts seem to play an important part of this question 4-4. Chomsky's accounts seem to play an important part in all of your careers and the careers of others. Is that right? And then if so,
the question is about chance encounters seeming to have caused important places in each of your careers. Is that right? And if so, I think Richard's asking who should he encounter next. So, are you up to start with, Nick?
Of course, they're not chance encounters. I mean, one selects where you're going to do graduate work, one selects, if you can, to a certain extent, who you'll work with, and so forth. But certainly, the point I was trying to make was that there is a certain historical contingency of being in a certain place at a certain time beyond maybe your own selection and control. And then, of course, there are probably people that each of us have met that we didn't interact with in ways that could have been enormously productive in some sort of way. So we may have many missed opportunities. But certainly, I think intellectual rapport and abilities to interact with other people and to take from them what kinds of things they offer certainly play an important role. I think everything is historically contingent in that sense. Yeah. I don't know who you should meet next. I have some favorite people that I'd like to get to know. Anybody else?
You know, one of the things in the literature on women in the professions and women in academia and so on is that, you know, these are on the basis of oral histories and interviews and things, that the women routinely tend to characterize their career path as a matter of chance and accident, right? And men routinely, or more typically, tend to characterize their careers as like, I had a goal, I spoke for it, right? So I'm really cautious about saying, oh yeah, it was all big accident. And probably the truth lies between the two for most people. But yeah, I mean, there's always the wisdom about, you know, sort of a discovery is a sort of prepared, you know, is a chance thing, but requires a prepared mind. And I think that's certainly true, right? That I'm sure there are plenty of opportunities that I missed because I didn't have the framework to recognize them. And then others that became really formative, conferences and so on, that became really formative for me because of some background that I had developed without the intention of going there, as it were. So I was engaged in feminist activism for political reasons, not for intellectual reasons originally. And yet that's been profoundly formative of my intellectual process. And as I say, I would say in ways that are intellectually enriching, that commit me to greater rigor in inquiry in some areas. By no means commits me to dogmatic, you know, somehow I know what it is in advance. You know what I mean? That engagement with feminist activists just made a nonsense of the argument that as a feminist you were somehow ideologically, it was predetermined what you'd believe. If you're a feminist activist, you, above all people, know, or a race critical activist, class activist, you know what the cost is of being wrong. You know how important it is to understand what the forces are you're working against, what the conditions are that you're entering. And so you might learn some uncongenial things about yourself and those you're working with. But you better know them if you're going to be effective. That was sort of a lesson learned in a context of political engagement that I see as exactly parallel in preparing me to think in certain ways, to draw on certain resources within philosophy of science. I don't know if the connection, maybe the connection isn't clear, but so there's how I see accident and a prepared mind, in a sense, as a consequence of action making a difference.
Yeah, I see it. What you said, Alison, is very important, I think, and it's really not about accident. It's about which opportunities do you take up, do you grasp at? And that's the skill, is not to choose the wrong opportunity. And that's something that you develop. You know, you can flitter around like an academic butterfly and choose every opportunity to go here, go there, do that, do this. And at some point, you have to go with other opportunities which maybe build on something that you've already done, so that you yourself develop a greater knowledge of which opportunity is better or which is not. And that's what you were talking about, I think, as well, which is to because that's what I found with working on in the field in Europe, was that I could have gone all over the place, but I just had to kind of choose particular opportunities. And when the opportunity came, for instance, to excavate the late Neolithic instead of Mesolithic to Neolithic transition, that was an opportunity that I had to take, because there would be no others, and then I had to adapt to that opportunity. And in doing that, all sorts of other things happen. So it's there isn't any rule. It's just... But it's not accident. And there are no coincidences.
And you always leave.
And you are what you eat.
Yeah. And you will recognize the Tom Robbins theme in this.
Well, I just think that an intellectual life is a life of dialogue, really. And I don't think it's about accidents. And to a degree about historical contingency. But you're only ever as good as the people around you. And it's important to remember that. I think that, that's one of the reasons why it matters enormously, talking to other people. And you can be certain that if you've thought of something, they've thought of it as well. Little humility goes a long way in academic life.
Another question. Yes. The girl behind. Yes.
Natalie White.
Natalie, who's a PhD student here, wants to know, did you ever have a moment of defeat? And what kept you going?
Of course, again, it's a different time period in the academic world, even over the decades. I've been teaching for 37 years, and in very different universities, three different public universities in the United States. So I certainly think, at a moment when, for example, in one of them I was told that I better do something very fast or I wasn't going to get tenure. And then you sort of step back and say, do I really want to do something very fast? And what should I do? And will it be of poor quality or should I just bail now, right? That kind of thing. And also when I was a graduate student, when I first came into anthropology at the University of Chicago, I was told by someone who at the time was assigned to me as an advisor that he thought it was silly that I should stay on and go for the PhD because, after all, I was just going to get married. And to this day, he keeps saying he never really said that. Because I write to him on my Berkeley letterhead, right? But nonetheless, so there are moments like that you have to say, should I take this guy seriously or should I just, And then, of course, I turned around and said to him, I married another archaeologist, so that sort of helped a little bit. So I think there certainly are moments like that, but I personally have never said I'm going to give it up, except I'm going to retire soon, and I'm really looking forward to that.
I think I haven't ever been able to give it up. Plenty of times I would have liked to. I think three times I've thought seriously about going into the law, twice at least about being a theatre director. And I think I would have been better off doing either of those things in some ways. But the point is that once you get the bug, once you're engaged on some particular kind of an intellectual project that is important to you, it's extremely difficult to give it up. That's the thing. It takes you, really, rather than the other way around.
No, you two never had a wobble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a wobble. I was wondering if Alison wanted to say her wobble. Well, I had a wobble. It was actually just before I went to America. It's actually when I came down to work, when I came down from Edinburgh to work with Peter Arco at the in this program that he was doing at UCL at that time on the history of material culture. And it was my first introduction to ethnography and looking at material culture from the point of view of people who were actually using it still, living people. And at that point I said, well, I got very, very depressed about archaeology. And I'm sure I wasn't the first one who got depressed about what archaeology could or could not tell you about the world and the past. And at that point I was going to become an ethno-archaeologist, just like Mike Rowlands or somebody like that. And then I was saved by this man, Hallam Movius, coming over from America, of all people. Hallam Movius came from America looking for somebody to fill a position at Harvard. And I was not going to, I thought, oh God, that's the last thing I want to do is go to America and be an archaeologist. Straight archaeologist. I wanted to get into this whole very exciting new way of looking at material culture. I wanted to go off and study people using material culture now and do that kind of work. But he came, and so they hired me. I went over there because I was just wanted a free trip to America. And they were very, they seduced me, basically, and with their wonderful goodwill and enthusiasm for what I was doing. That was the first time. You must know, you must have come across the whole British lack of, you know, it's not cool to be enthusiastic about what you're doing. And but they were all over me. Oh, this is so interesting. Great. And so I was completely seduced by that and agreed to become a straight archaeologist again. And so after that, I started to, once I got into the whole organization, the whole camaraderie of the new archaeology at that time, I not my straight sort of culture history, prehistoric Europe, but this other kind of archaeology, I was so excited by it. I was drawn right back into archaeology and forgot about my whole desire to do ethnoarchaeology. I was in a new country and made a difference as well. But anyway, so that was my almost.
I mean, my novels were not about the subject matter or the projects I was working on, but the fact that when I finished my PhD in 81, the philosophy job market was appalling. In fact, when I started graduate school, the American Philosophy Association sent a letter to every, or required departments to send a letter from the association to every grad student they admitted saying, do this if you're passionate about philosophy, but don't expect ever to get a job. There are none. I mean, literally, that, you know, I haven't found that letter. I bet it's in my file somewhere. But when I came out, I mean, in the U.S., so I was a Canadian studying in the U.S., I didn't have a lot of connection in Canada at that point. Came out of a state school, a program that didn't exist, a very third-ranked department. I mean, the credentials were really not compelling. In a job market where an open job in philosophy was drawing 300 to 500 applications, right? And in Canada, where it was a Canadian-only rule, they were drawing minimally 70. I mean, you get some variance in that depending on how narrowly jobs were defined. So I kind of went to ground and got a few years worth of postdocs, thinking, I just am going to write up the stuff I care about out of my dissertation, and then I'll go to law school. And I was really pissed off at the way some of the male colleagues had been treating my women of my cohort. And I was getting politicized around gender issues in the workplace. And I thought I wanted to, you know, get a law degree so I could kick ass, as they say. do something that might really matter in the world. But I was, you know, I had these projects I wanted to write up and get out. So I was going to do it as long as I could, you know, get income and sustain the moving around, which was like every year, because these were year-to-year postdocs. To my amazement, I did get postdocs in Canada, and just at the point when the one and only, well, here's an accident, right? The only job I've seen advertised in Canada with philosophy of social science as an area of specialization came up in my fourth year of postdocs, and I, by that time, had just enough track record to look viable for it, without credentials like Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or Princeton or whatever, that would really play for a brand new PhD in Canada. And so I got a job that I ended up being able to stay in and get tenured in. But the wobble really had to do with the fact that there were no jobs. 90% of the graduate students that I knew as philosophers on the job market, not just from my, you know, my program, ended up driving cab in New York and going to law school. There are very few of us in the cohort that I'm in. When I was hired, one other woman was hired at the University of Western Ontario, 85. They had not hired for 7 years. They didn't hire for another 5. And that's not an unusual demography for departments, a 12 to 15 year period in which maybe one or two people were hired. So that was the wobble. It wasn't a matter of choice, really, on my part.
We have to follow up Henrietta's whole theater director thing. Remember that he had one evening a reunion of the conference of the gender and women in production and prehistory conference. And Henrietta was there, you were there too, mm-hmm. And we all said we want to We want to change our professions, okay. And we want to become. We want to make an opera company. I was going to be the set designer because I was into multimedia, so at that point, and really wanted to get into theatre design. And Henrietta was going to be the theatre director. I think that Meg was going to be the stage manager. I can't quite remember. And what were you going to be?
I thought you were going to be singing and be a diva. And I, no. I did actually do set design.
Oh, that was, maybe that was it. Well, maybe I'm just
never mind.
Sort of
think about you set design.
Yes, that's right.
And thus is oral history made.
Yes.
Another question. Yes. Did you hear that, everybody?
No.
No, okay. The question from Joanna. Joanna? How much did your background in feminist politics mean that you could think you created change?
Yeah, so if we came from a political background and that influenced our intellectual work, has our intellectual work had any impact at all in the discipline? Well, you're closer to the action, in a sense, in anthro and archaeology.
Well, it's a sort of it's a bit difficult to answer that question, isn't it, in the sense that either you say it has and everyone thinks you're boasting, or you say it hasn't and everyone thinks you're a waste of time.
So,
I think it did. But my view, yes. And I think one of the things that's the most important thing about what we all do is that we teach. It's hugely important that people's minds have been changed dramatically by the theoretical frameworks that we've all put forward and the work that we've done. And I certainly think that that's true of my work. And also because the boundaries between academic feminism and feminist activism, at least in the United Kingdom, are extremely porous. And that's partly because the same individuals work in the classroom and on committees and on editorial committees and in certain contexts. But it's also because the ideas that we put forward, particularly through the end of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, were hugely important on all the groups who worked on things like wages for women, domestic violence, political activism, going on to the work that's been done on asylum seekers and refugees and so on and so forth. So yes, I think so.
I haven't had the opportunity until recently to teach in archaeology. Right? I moved to the University of Washington. I've been on the ground 1 year, and it's the first time I've had a cross appointment that's really functional with an archaeology group. So I don't know. I was going to say teaching, but I don't know that my teaching has had much impact on archaeologists. But certainly, being involved in to have the opportunity to be involved in developing women's studies programs in the 80s, which was something I was active on in Canada, to create space in which different kinds of scholarship could be done. I think that has, however that's sustained in whatever form that takes now, it's transmuting very quickly. I think that's been transformative in various ways. And then within the academy, the work that a group of us at the University of Western Ontario did on what was called chilly climate issues, the workplace environment issues. The shift in thinking was from a model in the US, they would say, of a civil rights era model of gender discrimination that required you to be able to identify either explicit barriers to access for women or minority scholars, or identify deliberate intention to discriminate. Right? So that's the sort of civil rights era model, as it's described in the 1999 MIT Women's Status of Women report at MIT. And the shift from that through the 80s and 90s to what MIT committee articulated in 99 is toward a model that can recognize the possibility of substantial inequality in outcome along gender and also race, ethnicity, and sometimes age lines, that isn't necessarily a function of deliberate intention or explicit barriers to access. It recognizes the cumulative effects of small-scale differences in uptake and response. There's good social psychology now to characterize how that's possible. And I think that the work that academic feminists have done, maybe not necessarily on workplace issues in academia, but the work that has been done on the status of women in the sciences, on the social psychology, cognitive schema, evaluation bias, stereotype mobilization research, the stuff on how hierarchies are constituted and reconstituted in small-scale interaction, that all provides a framework for shifting our understanding very substantially. And we're at a watershed right now where the MIT report was the first time that this alternative model of cumulative disadvantage, small-scale unintended consequences of small-scale unintended differences got public traction, at least in North America. And I think that potentially has enormous impact on how we address persistently reproduced, gender among other forms of inequality. So that's a hopeful, I hope not boastful, but a hopeful, read on how that's, how the intellectual work feeds back into political engagement.
I think I'll just add also that I think many of us who've been involved in the work that's called gender archaeology or whatever have maintained an explicit political stance that it does real political work, that we resist the kind of gender archaeology that denies or tries to suppress the political natures of it because of our situatedness. And many of us continue to work. I, for example, am the chair of the Academic Senate Committee of the Status of Women and Ethnic Minorities at the University of California at Berkeley and on a university system-wide committee. So I think many of us continue to put our commitments, and certainly what we get from archaeology actually has a lot to do with the way in which the human past has often been used to naturalize and legitimate some of these inequalities. And I think that we're very conscious of that and take many opportunities to try and problematize that tendency to legitimize and to naturalize some kinds of things that people would like to see in the here and now, but actually can't be sustained archaeologically in terms of evidence.
Gary, and then whoever it is at the back.
Gary, as an undergraduate, getting your achievement is obviously fantastic. But especially your undergraduate career, what do you think prepared you, or anything at all, prepared you
the kind of credible
aspect
of
life you left?
Yes,
let's go
to the order. Is there anything you're concerned about that you really say is the key in the undergraduate career?
Well, I went to a woman's, very well established women's college, now Holyoke College in Massachusetts in North America. Which, of course, was very good at the time in the early 1960s because, of course, we were all taken seriously as scholars, and that always helps. But I'd say, actually, what really prepared me and what I think prepares students today, because I think it's a very different time and place in many ways, is, for example, the engagement of undergraduates in the academic and research process. And we have a wonderful program at Berkeley where undergraduates can be sign up as research apprentices and actually work closely with faculty members and get a sense of their own work as researchers and how they can contribute to the whole research process. So I'd say, any ways in which you can get yourself engaged in ongoing work so you can see what it is all about if you're looking for a research kind of life. What it's all about is really, really ideal, and what kinds of things you thrive in, what kinds of things you can get passionate about. Because if you can't get passionate about something, you're not going to make it.
Anybody else got
I think exactly as I said about my graduate years, the really important thing was the sense of being part of a community, which has always been hugely important. And when I was an undergraduate, we were, again, a very tight community. And as Meg said, we one of the marvelous things about the archaeology we did is that we did get involved in fieldwork, and that really cemented a lot of relationships. And also, we had wonderfully charismatic teachers. I mean, my memory of my undergraduate years is being taught by amazingly charismatic teachers, and I won't mention, I'll spare the blushes of those who are sitting in this room, but they're now as young as they were, but they were young then when I was young. And I think that was a very important part of it as well.
I think that it's sort of hard because I'm not sure that the kind of undergraduate way of teaching that I was undergoing at that point when I was doing it, which was a very long time ago, would necessarily be what I would recommend to you. And I'm not sure what kind you're undergoing now, but I would really agree with both Meg and Henrietta that on the one hand, you need to really become passionate about inquiry. Not necessarily deep research, but some kind of inquiry, that you become part of a research community, which is what Henrietta's saying, that the opportunity there is in things like labs and in the field and so on, and that it's something sustained. It's not just something that happens just for one month in the summer, but that you have the opportunity to really follow up that. And I mean, the kind of teaching that we're doing now at Berkeley is for the most part, we try to make it inquiry based rather than lectures where you sit there like you're doing now, taking it all in, but you don't have any exam to spout it back to us. But you know, I almost never teach now with exams, and I almost never teach with a straight lecture, but in a kind of more give and take workshop method. And I think that's the kind of teaching. Hopefully, with the people who we're graduating from places like this and Berkeley and so on, are better prepared than I was when I became a graduate student.
I would just add to the business about following your passions and finding and embedding in a community. I found it extremely important to, if you have some focal problems that are really compelling, look for resources wherever you find them. Right? It's made an enormous difference for me to kind of poach across disciplinary lines. Don't allow disciplinary formation to bend you too much out of shape. Trust your instincts as an undergraduate who hasn't yet been too much steeped in the barrel, that you may have a creative take on the even questions that are very central to your discipline, canonical. But you may have a take on them. You may recognize possibilities for creative engagement that require using resources that lie outside the discipline that will really make a difference to, you know, how satisfying that work is for you and what its potential impact is on the field. So, you know, as you're getting a disciplinary formation, which in many ways you need, I would just like, don't let go of the breadth of vision that you bring as someone who isn't yet. I want some kind of like, you know, sort of, you haven't yet been like in this proprestrian bed and had all the bits kind of lopped off that don't fit, right? Take serious, like if you're in intuition, like why are they asking that question? Or why would you think that? Right? I mean, take those intuitions seriously. And even if the elders and betters are not all that supportive, right? And pursue those lines of inquiry wherever they lead you. Interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary work is enormously productive. And you have the resources coming new to a field to see possibilities that people long entrenched in the field may not. Yeah.
And look for people who encourage you to challenge authority.
Yeah, only not our authority. Everybody else.
You're saying that to a member of my college.
Oh.
except for my other.
Exactly.
There was somebody at the back, and then how many more people will want to ask questions? One, two. Okay, let's speed it up a bit. Somebody at the back wanted to ask a question.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
My name is Laura Carroll. I'm a graduate at Cambridge. Last year, we all had a course on the difference between feminist archaeology and an archaeology of gender. And I was wondering how the panel sees feminist archaeology in today's archaeology. Like, if it still feels that a feminist archaeology as opposed to an archaeology of gender that is still relevant and viable.
Okay, Meg, can you do that in three sentences?
Yes, I can. Actually, as I mentioned at the end of my talk, one of the kinds of things we've done, actually taking inspiration from philosophers of science, feminist philosophers of science, have been to turn the question around and say, how do we do archaeology as feminists? How do we bring our principles of feminist inquiry to bear on the practice of archaeology, which may or may not include a particular focus on gender? And I think what, as Helen Longino has taught us, trying to make sure you do work that doesn't disappear gender, but there's many other component parts to it. And actually, if I may, put in a little pitch, we've just published, Allison and I co-edited a volume that's just appeared. The most recent issue of the Journal of Archaeological Method and Theory is entitled Doing Archaeology as a Feminist. So you can take a look at that and see if there's some things in there that might be of help.
Anybody want to add to that?
Just that I've never seen feminism and the archaeology of gender as at odds. I think you have to have an extremely limited conception of feminism to see those as in tension. And an extremely limited conception of what responsible archaeology looks like to see those as incompatible. And that argument is made by several of us in the volume. Yeah.
Okay. Well, when I went to the London School of Economics to teach, they said, had published, of course, Feminism and Anthropology some years before. So when I arrived there, they said, oh, good, you can teach this course we have, which is called Kinship, Sex, and Gender. And I said, no, I'm going to teach Economic Anthropology, Political Anthropology, and something else, and you're all going to teach Kinship, Sex, and Gender, because I've written the book.
Well, yeah.
Right. And the next question.
My name is Marcel Olivia. I'm doing a PhD at Oxford. And my question almost leads on from that, because I arrived in archaeology from a literature theory background, from feminist literature. And I was very frustrated when I first arrived in feminist archaeology to find that it seemed as if you were all way behind the times. So it seemed to me like everything had happened, and all of a sudden in the 1960s and early 70s, and all of a sudden in the 1980s and late 1980s and even, you know, 1990s, you know, archaeology was tagging on to things that had already happened in literature theory. And that has since dispelled, it has since mellowed, but I was wondering whether or not you think that was a sort of an apt response, and that is something that maybe you felt that it took a long time to get to where you are now, and that maybe that is a reason why people are still concerned with the stereotypical political aspects of feminism and archaeology and still worry about it a bit.
Mm. So. Okay, were you a tortoise-like?
Well, you know, my perspective is that it may have taken a while to get a lot of what we consider under this broad rubric to happen in archaeology. And I think that had a lot to do with the social and political nature of archaeology, not just having to do with feminism, but having to do with its role in the world. And not recognizing the political role that archaeology has played and continues to play. And that there have been resistances, and I think that's tied up with some of the objectivity notions coming out of some of the positivism of new archaeology, and that there was a whole sort of context within which, but I think that there was a lot of work being done. We know that in the 1970s, the Norwegians started a whole journal on women in archaeology. So I think saying that it came late has as much to do with the power structures and the institutional reward systems of the discipline as it has to do with the mobilization of, you know, it's certainly the case today that in Eastern North America, more than half of the undergraduates in archaeology are women, and there's still a strong sort of perspective. There have been some wonderful articles and so forth. I'm not so worried about the fate of a delayed feminist archaeology as I am with the dialogues that are required for people to understand the kinds of things. And why are there those kinds of resistances? And I think that is a conversation that needs to be had about a lot of dimensions of archaeology, not just the feminist one.
And I would just add that one key dimension is the epistemic.
Yeah.
It seems to me one of the main constraints is this presumption that if you approach research as a feminist, you have somehow profoundly compromised your research practice. And there's a ton of excellent and non-relativist, non-meltdown, you know, we don't know anything literature, that in which, you know, the sort of rubric of values in science, in which the arguments are being made that the old sort of gnarly positivist framework, in, you know, the, in which ideals of objectivity are conceptualized in terms of value freedom, a complete non-starter. The absence of values is not going, you know, first of all, unattainable as a stance, and secondly, is not going to actually improve the robustness of the of research practice, right? So in, this is an argument made in terms of all kinds of fields. If I think we could just all get over the idea that the credibility of a knowledge claim should be adjudicated in terms of the presumed neutrality or value in, you know, freedom of the, I mean, it's an ad hominem argument, right? You judge the claim in terms of how you judge the person presenting it. And I'm committed to model ideals of objectivity, but they have to do with, like, what family of epistemic virtues do we want to realize in our knowledge claims? And it's perfectly clear from a legacy of feminist interventions in a range of fields that sometimes political commitment raises, often it raises the bar. You actually raise the standards of empirical adequacy and theoretical robustness if you're a feminist and it matters to get things right on a particular question or to critically examine assumptions that had never even been articulated. So, you know, it's I think one of the main constraints for feminist resources to really play a role productively in archaeology and not be kind of monster barred as a threat, which seems still to be an issue, will be to rethink those fundamental epistemic issues.
Which is why I think it's a much wider issue.
It's
for
a
all
much
of our
broader, yeah.
Right.
And not just to open space for feminist work, but to recognize, for example, indigenous archaeologists as having major contributions to the field of a serious, rigorous, core variety, not a sort of add-on or purely sort of research ethics capacity, but is really substantially reshaping the core of the discipline in epistemically positive terms.
Okay. No comment?
No.
I just want to point out that I don't think that you
behind
the times.
Well, I think some of the literature certainly still is.
Well, we're delighted to hear that. Somebody over there had a question. Marta wants to speak, and you would like to speak, so.
Should answer that question.
Yeah, come on. What was the result of the dare? Because actually, if it had reward, you mustn't ask the panel. You've got to produce it for yourself.
I think the audience were very quiet.
Okay.
But I think you'll figure something. You will. You're thinkers. You're going to do the work. You want to do the work. You're excited about it. You'll think of ways. You'll read. You'll do all these things. And so, you know, I don't think any of us are here to prescribe, you know, what you should do or where you should go or whatever, but I think that if you're thinking, as you will be, you'll think of things and you'll draw on things and you'll try to make archaeology better. I mean, I think in the job better, more responsive to its publics, and the kinds of issues that are current today. So, you know, I don't think it's a dare. I think it's inevitable if you're doing archaeology well.
I think that you just have to let the theory come through practice. That would be my, rather than create the theory from top down. So my challenge would be to do some really engaging practice, something which makes us interested in what you are doing.
Well said. Mark, you wanted to say something? Sorry, she was just ahead of you. Can I do her first and then you? Okay, Martha.
Okay, I'm Martha here in Cambridge. Not a student, I'm afraid.
She doesn't get wine.
I
get wine, no.
Four fascinating personal histories for four women. and a lot of about feminism. And feminism is about the rights of women. And I consider one of my rights also to have children. And none of you mentioned it. And I found that more, it's quite hard to combine children and work, and full-time work. So I wonder what you think. Is it harder or easier today for a woman to work full-time, have a career, be an archaeologist, feminist or not, and have children? Is it easier today than it was in the 70s?
I think when we were on the Cambridge University Women's Action Group, and we QAG, as it was called, and we did this work in the 1980s, we discovered that the University of Cambridge employed fewer women full time in 1980 than it had done in 1935 or something. And that had to do with the larger numbers of women entering part time work. And I think that, you know, the things that dictate women's work and the rhythm of women's work change quite dramatically, and they're everything from, you know, discursive views about the place of women and of motherhood and the importance of children and so on, which are very much back on the agenda in the United Kingdom at the moment, to such things as tax regimes, right? So you've got a very, very broad range of things which impinge on your life when you have children, right? Now, the question of whether it's harder or easier, I think, is extremely difficult to judge. It's a challenge, because basically it's a matter of doing more than one job, right? And I'm not sure about it, but one thing I can tell you quite explicitly, in case you were answering this question, right, is that I am not happy about the recent political shift in the United Kingdom, which talks really about, you know, how women should be reprioritising children over their careers. I think this is an invidious division. It's always been an invidious division, and it will continue to be so. Right? I don't really find myself at all sympathetic to that politics, but that is not the same thing as saying that you shouldn't have children.
It's not. I think in the States, anyway, the challenge is really infrastructural. And really, I heard a fascinating talk about the way in which the situation, for example, in Iran, which was often tyrannized by the West for its supposed lack of women's rights, they actually have incredibly more substantive childcare at the place of employment, where they provide free transportation to get the children from the daycare to home or to other places. We have nothing like that in kind of infrastructure support for those who wish to choose to have children and a career of whatever sort. And so I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done at the infrastructure level, but I think really it's a matter of personal choice, and those of us who have had children, as I have, and I've now got several grandchildren and a third one on the way in a month. And, you know, for those of us, it is a matter of choosing and trying to figure out how you can best sustain it, even with a fieldwork practice. I, for example, did not take a really long-term in the fieldwork project until later, after tenure. I did some fieldwork, but finding alternative things, and for that, it often means changing the reward system of the institution. So that, for example, many times people in archaeology are judged on whether or not they're digging their site. And if you're not digging your site, then you're not going to get the publications and the reward system. And I think we need to broaden the reward system to take into account a variety of contributions that people can make with their research, and not just have excavation, for example, for all sorts of reasons, as be the standard by which someone's success is measured. I think there's a lot that can
yes, be. Yes, it's worth bearing in mind. The new research from the States shows that when people have this attitude that women who are single mothers, that they have chosen to have children to get onto welfare, right? And really what they need to do is to be married to a decent man. And we have the same problem here in the United Kingdom, to be married to a decent man so they have an adequate living. Okay, the latest research shows they'd have to be married to three men to have a decent standing.
You may like to know, those of you who want answers to that question, that this university, with Oxford, with Berkeley, with Yale, with Peking and Singapore and ANU and Japan, are working on a whole project called Women in the Academy. And what is known as over there as the leaky faucet. Why do women not stay in the academy? That is a quite different subject
but it's going to be a very interesting cross-cultural thing because we don't know the answers. We think we do, but childcare is too simple an answer to that.
It's not just childcare.
Yeah, okay, no, you wanted to ask a question. Let's get off this one.
I'm Jordan Anderson. I'm our first year at the School of Oriental African Studies, was quite sadly omitted from the list earlier.
I'm so sorry.
You mentioned the continuing role of political archaeology you mentioned. I was wondering, now that a lot of the feminist ideas you were coming up with in the 60s and 70s have been accepted and being taught in some cases, what new political ideologies are driving new developments in archaeology now?
Well, in the States, I think there's a great concern with the development of what's called indigenous archaeologies and the role of different interpretations and interpretive strategies for looking at archaeological materials. So I certainly think that and many of the programs and so forth that are being developed by the World Archaeological Congress, if you're not familiar with that, you can just go on the internet and see that a kind of archaeological organization that's really concerned with social archaeology and social justice. So I think there's quite a bit of that and curriculum change to incorporate various kinds of perspectives and paradigm.
What are they doing? Go on.
I'm a little bit concerned about the way in which we're thinking about the academic endeavour as also many people in the audience seem to be, as being quite separate from the kind of the rest of the life that one leads. You can only be an intellectual in a context. There's only a purpose in being an intellectual and having purchase in a context, in the context in which you live and work. Okay. So at the moment, the things that drove us are not the things that are driving lots of young scholars now, because the things that are driving lots of young scholars now are the things that have happened post 9/11. The things that are happening with the war in Iraq, the things that are happening because of the enormous rise of religiosity, which is hugely important in public life. When I first entered the social sciences, we believed in secularism. We thought religion was finished. We thought this was modernization. Okay? There wasn't going to be any more religion. Right? Now, you know, the great debates, the philosophical debates that are going on now about post-secularism and so on are bound to have the most enormous effect on the way we think about and practice social science. In anthropology and in archaeology, it's impossible not to have those discussions because of the way in which they connect with issues around nationalism and imperialism and post-imperialism and the forms of military oppression and conflict and so on. So the things that drive your work very largely will be pretty clear, I would have said, right? Because this pattern doesn't look like it's going away within, you know, by the end of next week.
One more question and then I'm going to call it a day. Who wants the last word? Do you have a question?
This is perhaps not a very good last question, but it's mainly a question for him. I'm James Holloway. I'm a PhD student here in the department. I wanted to ask a question about you talked about an attitude of intellectual optimism within the department in the late 1970s during the 1980s. I wonder if you could take a moment to discuss what role, if any, the foundation of ARC played in that, and whether you felt that sort of...
Oh, yes. Sheila Crawford and me. Right.
Yeah.
And somebody else, yes. Oh, yes.
It's your question.
Right. Well, yes, I mean, that was part of it. I mean, in the sense that we felt very strongly that there should be a voice for the new kind of thinking that was emerging and a voice for postgraduates in the department. And there was the Cambridge Anthropology on the other side, right? And, I mean, I was actually... somebody asked me about this question before, and I'm not quite sure... I saw Sheena recently and I asked her about it, and suppose she's not here because she'd have given a much fuller answer to this, because she seemed to remember much more than I did about it. And in fact, I think you sent someone to interview me recently, didn't you? Or tried to send someone to interview me about this recently. I think I said that I couldn't remember very much about it. I'm embarrassed by this because what I remember is that was exactly the kind... We were taking initiatives like this all the time. That was exactly the kind of thing that we were doing. And so, yes, I don't know how much influence it had on the department subsequently, but it was certainly something that we thought was important, yeah, and that we devoted a lot of time to.
Right. Well, with that lapse of
memory. It's an appropriate place to end, isn't it?
I think this is... So, personal histories you've heard today and the reflections on the questions you've asked have been... fascinating.
a book list might be issued eventually by Pamela Jane in response to all of this. We'd like to thank her again, but in particular we'd like to thank the four people who have told all, or most of it anyway, this evening. Thank you very much indeed. Have offered a bottle of wine to every undergraduate who wrote to ask a question, and I wrote you all down, so no others may claim. But there is wine back in the McDonald's now, and if you're claiming a signed copy of something or other that Pamela, last year's DVD, Julie is doling them out. Thank you very much indeed.